The way we approach these problems, remember, we're starting from a mathematical point of view with a set of nonlinear ordinary differential equations. Well, where did they come from? They came from some hypothesis of ours about an underlying molecular regulatory network that's controlling some aspect of cell physiology. Okay, we think that this is the correct molecular network. We convert the network into nonlinear differential equations, and we're trying to associate the solutions of the differential equations with the physiological behavior of the cell. And so we have to study the nature of the solutions of those differential equations. And this is why bifurcations are so important, because it's at bifurcations that, in some sense, the nature of the solution of the differential equation undergoes a dramatic change. That's the definition of a bifurcation point. So that's where the cell's physiology can change. If you're not close to a bifurcation point, then the solutions aren't changing very much in a qualitative fashion, and the physiology should be the same. You know, the details, the strength of the response or something like that is going to be different, but the nature of the response isn't going to be different until you cross a bifurcation point. So that's why we want to locate these bifurcation points. And we find bifurcation points by first doing a one-parameter bifurcation diagram, looking at how solutions change with respect to one parameter and trying to find unusual places, unusual events. Those are the codimension one bifurcation points. And next, we want to understand, well, how do those bifurcation points depend upon the other parameters in our system? And to investigate that, we draw a two-parameter bifurcation diagram. So the main parameter is, say, the signal that's inducing a particular response in the system, and the other parameters are, say, you know, gene expression in the control system that modulates the signal response characteristics of the cell. And we want to be able to characterize how the signal response characteristic depends upon, say, the expression of other genes in the system. That'll tell us how the genetics of the cell governs its physiology. That's why two-parameter bifurcation diagrams are important. And what the two-parameter bifurcation diagram is going to do for us, it's going to show us how the one-parameter bifurcations are related to each other, and how the bifurcations arise, and how the different bifurcations fit together. So that's what I'm going to try and do next. Any questions at this point? So these are like, I really think of this like a jigsaw puzzle. We're trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle that's going to tell us how all these pieces fit together in dynamical space. The wiring diagram is a jigsaw puzzle of how the proteins and genes kind of fit together and interact with each other. But it's those interactions determine the dynamics of the system. And the two-parameter bifurcation diagram shows you how the dynamics of the system fit together and are derived from each other. So let's do our first two-parameter bifurcation diagram to try to complete the picture around the degenerate Hopf bifurcation. So remember, so now on slide 38, I said that at a degenerate Hopf bifurcation, we're following a locus of Hopf bifurcations, and it changes from supercritical Hopf to subcritical Hopf. The stability of the limit cycle changes. And the theory of the degenerate Hopf bifurcation says that there must be a locus of cyclic folds in the neighborhood of the degenerate Hopf bifurcation. So not only do we find this locus of Hopf bifurcation, where it changes from super to sub, but associated with that codimension 2 bifurcation is a locus of cyclic folds that peels away from the locus of Hopf bifurcations. And peeling away is a good description, because these curves, the locus of Hopf bifurcations and the locus of cyclic fold bifurcations, have to come together at a tangency at the codimension 2 bifurcation. A tangency means they have the same slope when they finally merge at the codimension 2 bifurcation. So the cyclic fold peels away from the Hopf bifurcation. And what you see is, as you cross the supercritical Hopf bifurcation, it's a simple situation. A stable steady state changes to an unstable steady state surrounded by a stable limit cycle. And the stable limit cycle is gathering trajectories from the outside that are coming in. As you cross the subcritical Hopf bifurcation, you bifurcate away an unstable limit cycle. And the unstable limit cycle is in some sense surrounded by a stable limit cycle. Because the stable limit cycle on the outside is catching all the trajectories that are still coming into the region where you used to have a stable steady state. And as you move further away from the subcritical Hopf bifurcation, the unstable limit cycle grows in amplitude and eventually coalesces with the stable limit cycle, and they annihilate each other at the cyclic fold. And when we get past the cyclic fold, we now have just a stable steady state and no limit cycles. Okay? So these steady states and limit cycles have to fit together in this fashion. And just like a jigsaw puzzle, the pieces fit together, but the pictures on the pieces also fit together. The pictures are my little sketches of what the vector field looks like. And this picture now is completely consistent. And this is the way these different kinds of bifurcations have to be pieced together. And this is sometimes called an unfolding of the codimension 2 bifurcation. The unfolding is just a diagram like this that shows you what the vector field looks like in the neighborhood of the codimension 2 bifurcation. Okay, Tongli? The cyclic fold always comes in on the side of the subcritical Hopf. When they're tangent as I've drawn it. It's not tangent on the side of the supercritical Hopf. Not off the top of my head, but sit down and try and draw it. I don't think you'll be able to draw it. Now, you can change the stability of everything. Just turn time around, and it'll all look alike. So that would be a. So what if we reverse time? Would this look like a subcritical Hopf bifurcation? I guess it would, wouldn't it? I mean, this is the way I've drawn it. Is the way the picture looks. Like usually, but if you reverse time, everything should also fit together. And maybe that's the case you're thinking of. Because I could have, out here I could have an unstable limit cycle, an unstable steady state, then a stable steady state. And then this stable steady state crosses a supercritical Hopf and throws off a stable limit cycle, and then the stable limit cycle grows and annihilates. Yeah, okay, so that's the case you were thinking of. But I don't usually think of it that way, because then in the neighborhood of where all this is happening, the whole system is unstable to begin with. Trajectories are flying away from the local neighborhood. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a possibility. Okay? So let's have a look now at the double zero bifurcation on slide 39. This is called a Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation, and it's a very complicated bifurcation, but it's also a very common codimension 2 bifurcation. So you really have to get used to Takens Bogdanov bifurcations, because you're going to see them all the time. A Takens Bogdanov bifurcation is a double zero bifurcation. Two eigenvalues are real and equal to zero. Now, there are two different ways that this can happen. Okay, so remember, we're talking about the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix in the vicinity of the steady state. And two of those eigenvalues goes to zero. And there are two ways that it can happen. It can happen if you're following a locus of saddle node bifurcations. Along the locus of saddle node bifurcations, one eigenvalue is equal to zero, and at a certain point along that locus, a second real eigenvalue becomes zero. And as I explained earlier, the saddle node changes from a saddle plus stable node to a saddle plus an unstable node. But there's a completely different way that this can happen, and that is if you're following a locus of Hopf bifurcations where you have a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues with the real part equal to zero and the imaginary part is not equal to zero. That's the condition for it to be a Hopf bifurcation. But you're following this locus of Hopf bifurcations, the real part is equal to zero, and you're keeping your eye on the imaginary part, and by golly, the imaginary part is getting smaller and smaller and smaller as you go along this Hopf bifurcation. And eventually the imaginary part goes to zero as well as the real part being zero. And now you have, again, a double zero, two real eigenvalues that are equal to zero. But it happened by a different route. And that's why at a Takens-Bogdanov bifurcation, a locus of saddle node bifurcations and a locus of Hopf bifurcations come together and fit together at the codimension 2 bifurcation point. So at the Takens-Bogdanov bifurcation point, you always have a locus of saddle nodes and a locus of Hopfs, and they come together at a tangency. So the Hopf bifurcation line is tangent to the saddle node line at the codimension 2 bifurcation point. Okay? And that's kind of a requirement of a double zero.
And this is a supercritical Hopf, right?
I haven't said yet. Well, I've drawn it as if it were a supercritical Hopf. But there are two different flavors of Takens-Bogdanov. Okay, so I'll explain this one first, and then I'll explain the other one. Now, the interesting thing about this, and the surprising thing about it, is you can prove that at a Takens-Bogdanov bifurcation point, in addition to the locus of saddle node bifurcations and the locus of Hopf bifurcations, there must also be a locus of saddle loop bifurcations. They're required. And that's a homoclinic orbit. In general, it's a non-local bifurcation. But in the vicinity of Takens-Bogdanov bifurcation point, there has to be a homoclinic connection locally in the neighborhood of the steady state. And there has to be a locus of saddle loops that's also coming into the Takens-Bogdanov and coming in at a tangency. So all three lines are tangent to each other when they enter the Takens-Bogdanov point. And so it's highly degenerate. And there's a lot of action in the neighborhood of a Takens-Bogdanov bifurcation point. Okay? So these three lines divide the parameter space up into 1, 2, 3, 4 different segments. And in each segment, the vector field looks different. Within each segment, the vector field is robust. It's generic. It doesn't change qualitatively as we move around within the segment. But as we cross the bifurcation line, something unusual happens and we get a new picture on the other side of the bifurcation line. Okay? So let's take a tour around Takhmanov-Bogdanov bifurcation point and see what happens as we go from one section to the other. So we'll start to the right where there are no steady states. And the vector field is just kind of sailing through this neighborhood. It's moving slowly because there are steady states close by in some sense. Okay, so the vector field is slow. It's sluggish here. As we cross the saddle node bifurcation on the lower part of the line, we bifurcate away a stable steady state. When it first bifurcates away, it's a stable node. As it gets a little further away, it might change into a focus, but that doesn't matter. Topologically, there's no difference between a node and a focus. I've drawn it as if it were a stable focus, but it could also be a stable node. Okay, so we have a saddle point and a stable node. Now, as we pass through this section and cross the hop bifurcation, the stable node, or the stable focus, right, it has to change from a node to a focus before it crosses the hop bifurcation, right? Because at a hop bifurcation, it has to be a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues. So it changes to a focus, and it changes from a stable focus to an unstable focus and throws off a stable limit cycle. Okay? So that's what happens as I move clockwise along the bottom of this figure. But now, let's move counterclockwise along the top. So as I cross the saddle node on the upper part, I have to bifurcate off a unstable node. So I've drawn now in the upper segment here a saddle point and an unstable steady state. And the trajectory is coming away from the unstable steady state, go towards the saddle point, and then of course they go away from the saddle point. And that's where the homoclinic bifurcation comes from, because these two pictures have to somehow fit together. We have the unstable steady state here, which is that unstable steady state up there, but this is surrounded by a stable limit cycle, and we have to get rid of the stable limit cycle. And the only way to get rid of the stable limit cycle now is for it to undergo a homoclinic bifurcation with the saddle point. So that's the saddle loop connection, which destroys the stable limit cycle and leaves you with the unstable steady state. So the hop bifurcation, the hop bifurcation is associated here because of the double zero eigenvalue. That's what makes the hop bifurcation enter into the picture. And the hop bifurcation allows you to change the stability of the steady state from a stable focus to an unstable focus. But at the hop bifurcation, you can't avoid throwing off a limit cycle, and then you have to get rid of the limit cycle. You have to destroy the limit cycle, so that's done by the saddle loop bifurcation, gets rid of the limit cycle. And now all these pictures fit together. And on each one of these one codimension one bifurcation lines, you can draw the what the vector field looks like, right? And it'll be non-generic because there'll be something like a saddle node coalescence or a homoclinic orbit or something like that. Along each one of these lines, there's a codimension one bifurcation occurring. And right at this point where everything fits together, which is the codimension two bifurcation point, the vector field is doubly degenerate. And I try to draw the double degeneracy of the vector field in this little inset box, which is trying to indicate that there are two real eigenvalues equal to zero. So this steady state is highly degenerate you kind of come into the steady state just from one side, from the southeast, and you go out of that steady state to the northeast, but the vector field kind of swings around it on the other side because the, you know, locally the vector field is highly degenerate. The first order terms don't describe the flow around this steady state. Okay? Now, as I said, the Takhnov-Bogdanov bifurcations come in two flavors, and the other flavor we get just by reversing time, by changing the direction of all the arrows on the flows. And now what happens is, as we cross the lower saddle node bifurcation, we throw off an unstable steady state. And as we cross the hub bifurcation, it's a subcritical hub bifurcation, and the steady state becomes stable, and we get an unstable limit cycle. And then as we cross the saddle loop bifurcation, the unstable limit cycle gets destroyed by the homoclinic connection, and then when we are all in the other region, we have a saddle point and a stable node. And actually, this second one is the kind of Takhnov-Bogdanov bifurcations that you usually see in chemical reaction systems. So the usual case at a Takhnov-Bogdanov is you throw off a subcritical Hopf bifurcation and you have an unstable homoclinic orbit. Now, as you follow them away from a Takhnov-Bogdanov, as you follow them away, they will probably change their stability. The subcritical Hopf bifurcation will change to a supercritical Hopf bifurcation at a degenerate Hopf bifurcation. But we know when it passes through a degenerate Hopf bifurcation, it has to throw off a cyclic fold, right? And that cyclic fold has to go somewhere. Similarly, as you follow the saddle loop bifurcation away from the Takhnov-Bogdanov, it also will change from throwing off an unstable limit cycle to throwing off a stable limit cycle. And when it does that, it must also throw off a cyclic fold. And those cyclic folds may connect to each other. It may be that a cyclic fold that comes off at a degenerate Hopf bifurcation ends up somewhere else in the two-parameter space at a degenerate saddle loop bifurcation. But eventually, all these bifurcations are going to have to fit together. So as I said, it is just like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. You find out what the rules are for how it has to look locally, but then all the pieces have to fit together globally as well to make a sensible scene. Okay? And the boats on your scene better be in the lake and not in the clouds somewhere, unless it's some kind of a acid trip who built the jigsaw puzzle. Okay? So we're going to have to learn how these pieces fit together, and you use the tool of auto to follow these bifurcation lines and use the theory to understand how they have to fit together. And then you just have to keep looking at your picture until it's a complete picture, until all the pieces fit together. And you can tell when they don't fit together pretty easily. And what you'll have to follow, you may have a Takhnov-Bogdanov and you haven't found the homoclinic orbit yet. Okay, so you have to use auto to find the homoclinic and follow the homoclinic and then see where it goes. Okay, so I'm going to stop here in this lecture, and next week we'll pick up on some others. Well, I think what we're going to do next week, we're going to do an example from chemical reaction theory that uses all these different kinds of codimension 1 and codimension 2 bifurcations to fully describe the dynamics of a simple chemical reactor. This is a classical problem that was solved back in the 80s, and it's very worth our time to go through that particular example. So let's stop there.